Okay, next up is Ben Grillo. Ben Grillo is a record collector and archivist currently living and working in New York City. His Ohio roots run deep. Ben was born in Dayton and received his bachelor's degree from the University of Toledo. He has a master's in library science from the University of Maryland, College Park, and has worked in audio and video preservation for nearly 2 years. And Ben's going to tell us about the rise and fall of King Records, founded by Sid Nathan in 1943, Cincinnati.
Thank you. I'm going to be moving back and forth because my slides are here. But again, I'd like to thank David and Patrick for their great presentation. Mine moves a little bit later in time. We're going to go into 1940s and 50s music from the turn of the century. But I want to start out by describing what I'm going to do. And I'm going to give a brief overview of King Records. I'm going to assume that people, although a lot of you know a great deal about it, don't know a whole lot. And I'm going to give an overview of Sid Nathan, who's the gentleman pictured here, talk about some of the artists, his business practices, and give a general overview of the arc of the label, the trajectory that it took. Sid was born in 1904. He had asthma, poor eyesight. People would describe him later. He had big, thick Coke bottle glasses, chili-stained tie. He later developed heart conditions. He was a lifelong smoker. He dropped out of high school as a freshman. He had played the drums since the age of 5 and he lived in a racially mixed neighborhood and would often play with jazz bands or various combos of various sizes. He enjoyed all sorts of music, but he was exposed to a wide variety of music from a very early age. He worked after he dropped out of high school as a freshman in 9th grade in pawn shops, jewelry sales. He did park concessions. He was a busboy. He was a shooting gallery operator, and an interesting story when he was a shooting gallery operator, a police report was called in on him for obtaining money under false pretenses because a gentleman shot out the heart on the Ace of Hearts card, brought it up to Sid, and Sid said that he could still see a speck of red with his magnifying glass and refused to pay. They called the police in on him, and he had a warrant out. He ended up settling out of court. Now, that gives you an idea of the sort of tough operator that Sid Nathan was from the very beginning. He was a wrestling promoter, which I can only imagine what sort of hijinks he got into in those sorts of situations. He occasionally would travel south. He went to Arizona briefly for his asthma. He went to Florida for a while and worked with his brother as a photo developer. But in 1938, 1939, he opened his record shop in Cincinnati. He developed pictures in the back room to make ends meet. And it was there that he really got his start. A man owed him $6, and Sid saw him every night at the same nightclub with a different beautiful woman. And finally, Sid pulled him aside and said, "You know, if you can make it every night here with these wonderful girls, surely you can give me my $6. The next day, the guy shows up with 300 jukebox records. He was a jukebox dealer, would go around. He said, "I'll give you these to you for 2 cents a piece. That's my $6. We're even." Sid figured he could sell enough to make back his $6. So he took them, and in the first day made $18. And he very quickly realized that there was a lot of money to be had. These jukebox records were both country, western, R&B, jazz. There were a wide variety of records, and he was in the right place at the right time. Cincinnati in the late 1930s. Let me go to a brief timeline of the record label here. Cincinnati in the late 1930s was a mixing pot. People were coming north for factory jobs. A 1950 Saga article, profile of Sid, put it really poetically, described the individuals coming north. They were wandering into Sid's store, those tall, gaunt-faced folks with the lonesome sound of the mountains in their talk. For them, the war was the real thing, and Cincinnati factory smokestacks were beckoning with plumes of smoke, signaling them to come up from Kentucky and Tennessee and over from West Virginia. And that was true not just for Appalachians, but for African Americans coming up from the South. And as a result, the radio station in Cincinnati, WLW, had several popular radio programs, the Boone County Jamboree, the Midwestern Hayride, focusing on a variety of performers the Delmore Brothers, Cowboy Copas, Merle Travis, Grandpa Jones, the list goes on and on. So Cincinnati really was a place to be at that point in time. Also conducive to starting a record company in the late 1930s, early 1940s, there was the Petrillo Band, which I'm sure you all are familiar with, musicians strike against major labels for royalties. Prior to that, they've been paid primarily by session work, and the strike was to get royalties. The majors could afford to, well, I'm not saying they could afford to hold out, but they had chosen to hold out, whereas an independent record label such as King and a number of others across the country at the same time said, let's play games, let's play ball, and let's, you know, let's put records out. So major labels were also starting to focus on pop and vocal records because the vocalists weren't in the musicians' union and they could continue to make money on the crooners and the singers. And so it left an opening for rural genre music for the minor labels to take over. In 1943, as fate would have it, Alton Delmore of the Delmore Brothers wandered into Sid's record shop looking for copies of his own records to send to a transcriber to make sheet music, because that was a major way that he was making money during the ban, aside from radio station gigs. I've got a quote here from the Delmore biography that describes what Alton saw that day when he walked into the store. So I called out again, and then Sid Nathan came out. He was all stained with the dyes of the pictures he'd been developing. He had on double-lens glasses. He was fat and short with all that coloring. He looked like someone from another planet. His hands were held up to keep the color from getting on his clothes, and he really looked like a groundhog just emerging from his hole in the ground. Which I think is, you know, is a really good way to put it. Sid asked him who he was. He said, you know, I'm Mr. Delmore. Sid said, I've made so much money selling your records, just take them. And he gave Alton the records right there in the shop. And then said, by the way, Alton, do you know any of those guys down that you perform with at WLW? And very quickly, the connection was made. And Sid was able to take two of the early stars, Grandpa Jones and Merle Travis, to Dayton, Ohio, my hometown, to record the very first King record in 1943. It was cut in Dayton and was pressed by the American Printing House for the Blind in Louisville, and it sounded absolutely terrible. One reporter put it that it sounded like it should have been recorded for the people for the deaf. It was really, really a really poor recording. But based on the sales of this, which were okay, Sid was able to find some investors. It was mostly friends and family, and started the label properly in 1944 for less than $25,000. He built a house. He found a former ice house on Brewster Avenue in a neighborhood called Evanston in Cincinnati. The early recordings were hillbilly. His first big hit was in 1945 with Cowboy Copas' Filipino Baby. In September of 1945, he established Queen Records. I've got an example of a Queen record here. The very first Queen record was made by Bull Moose Jackson, who is a Cleveland native, which is my Cleveland connection. And this record is a Bull Moose record, but it's not the first one. And you're welcome to come up and look at it after the presentation. The Honey Dripper was the first Bull Moose record, and as you can kind of tell from the title, King didn't shy away from racy material by any means. And we'll see that a little bit later on with Hank Ballard's Work With Me, Annie. It's another Bull Moose record. Initially, in addition to recording local artists, he bought the rights to other recordings. Other record companies had R&B records that he would then buy and then issue. One of the best things that he did early on was he went down to the local ballroom and Lucky Melinder's band played fairly often, a hotel downtown Cincinnati. And Lucky Melinder was under contract at the time, but he was able to hire his trumpeter, Henry Glover. And Henry Glover had worked with Buddy Johnson before, had a college degree in music education, and was a really knowledgeable individual. And he became an A&R man, an executive, in the late 1940s at King Records, which was a fairly rare position for an African American to hold at that time. He was essential to King's success. He smoothed over some of Sid's rough edges. Sid liked to jump and yell and scream. Session bassist described Nathan screaming, turning red, big cigar stuck in his mouth. And Henry would translate that into something that the musicians could understand and get a result that would sell records. And that was an essential skill. Henry Glover worked with country artists. He co-wrote songs with Moon Mullican. He produced the Delmore Brothers. One of their biggest hits and best records, in my opinion, is Blues Stay Away From Me. And he co-wrote that, and that sort of thing wouldn't have necessarily happened at that time in other studios, where you had this mixture of a man who had worked in jazz bands and small combos coming together with the best country artists at the time and really creating something that was fairly unique in the late 40s. That was common with King overall. R&B artists would do country songs. Winoni Harris did Bloodshot Eyes, which was a Hank Penny song. Bull Moose Jackson did Why Don't You Haul Off and Love Me, which is a Wayne Rainey song. And the reasons for this, although Sid did believe that music was music and it was all just one big fabric, were economic as well. Sid owned a publishing company, Lois Music, that would have the copyrights, and he liked it when he could get royalties twice. So if he had the rights to a song and he would release it one way, he'd like to see it sell the other way too. But racial blurring was a general policy at King. In 1947, he hired Ben Siegel as the personnel manager and pretty much let him do whatever he wanted. A 1949 article in the Cincinnati Post was entitled "Local Firm Smashing Jim Crow." And the company had an integrated baseball team within its own employees that it hired fairly representatively for the community. There's some evidence in some of the research that I saw to the contrary, where white session musicians would be paid more, the contracts would be better. But by and large, for a company in the late 40s in Cincinnati, it was fairly remarkable. By 1949, they were switching over to 45s. They brought in an engineer named Hal Neely, who did a lot for them. By the early 50s, they had slipped out of country. He'd always hoped to move back into the country field, but primarily focused on R&B throughout the early 50s, and this is when King hit its peak. He did get back into country later in the 50s. In 58, they hired the Stanley Brothers. He re-signed Hank Shaw Hawkins, who was one of his biggest stars early on, in 1962. Unfortunately, he tragically was killed in the plane crash that killed Patsy Cline, along with Cowboy Copas. Both Hank Shaw Hawkins and Cowboy Copas were King artists, and that pretty much put an end to King's later attempt at resurging its country line. But R&B from 51 through 55 was King's bread and butter, and they had a lot of very successful artists. I won't go into a lot of the names, but they formed a federal label subsidiary, primarily formed that subsidiary for a producer and A&R man named Ralph Bass. He had worked at Black and White before, would later go on to work at Chess. He found Hank Ballard through Johnny Otis. He found the Dominoes, the Platters, the number of vocal groups. But the one thing that he did find that sustained King further than it would have gone towards the end was in 1956, he heard James Brown's demo, went down to Macon, signed him. He was rather lucky in that because the Chess Brothers were trying to fly in from Chicago at the same time, but they got stuck in a snowstorm. And through a strange twist of fate, King was able to sign James Brown in 56. Sid hated the demo. He couldn't believe that Ralph had brought this person in to play music for him. He thought that the first single, Please, 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 was a stupid song. He said, it's one word said over and over, and he couldn't understand the appeal. He would jump up and down. He ended up firing Ralph Bass briefly for bringing James Brown into the studio. Reluctantly released the record, and it went on to sell several million copies. It was number five on the R&B charts, which was rather impressive. The next 3 or 4 years, Brown didn't do a whole lot. Sid was about to fire him in 59, but he had another hit called Try Me. He spent most of that time on the road building his band and building a national following. The same sort of story about Sid resisting James happened again in 62 with the live album Live at the Apollo. Sid wouldn't believe that people would buy a live album of songs they already owned. And just, you know, he thought it was a terrible idea. And in the end, James ended up putting up his own money and recording his own show, which King then released and became one of their best-selling records, period. As I said, they really hit their peak in the early 50s. By the late 50s, their infrastructure was too much for what they were selling. Their record sales had dropped from 500,000 copies a year to 200,000, 300,000 copies a year, and they were losing money. By the early 60s, Sid was having health problems, handed the company over to Hal Neely primarily, and 65 gave up the distribution system just as Papa's Got a Brand New Bag was one of the best-selling songs they'd had. The record basically became James Brown towards the end. It got sold a couple times, first to Start A, then they sold James Brown's contract to Polydor for a couple million dollars, and a company called the Tennessee, TRB was the initial, Lieber Stoller and Hal Neely bought the rights to King back, which they then eventually sold to Gusto, who is currently doing the reissues. Some of the unique things about Sid's business style, which I've kind of touched on intermittently, is that he had good judgment at certain periods of time, but he also made some fairly big mistakes. In addition to the James Brown's mistakes, Cowboy Copas went down to Nashville periodically and would buy songs for him, and heard about a song called Tennessee Waltz that was up for sale. He said, well, it's nothing but a copy of a different waltz, so we don't really need that one. And they wanted $15 for it anyway. And Sid said, yeah, you're right, Cowboy, no song's worth $15. So that song obviously went on to be worth a great deal. An interesting thing about King that enabled them to survive for as long as they did was they were a completely vertically integrated shop. Their ice house on Brewster Avenue in Cincinnati did everything. There was a recording studio, the record presses were there, the artwork department was there, they could make the LP cases, they could make the 45 sleeves, the 78 sleeves. They had their own distribution network and they could sell anywhere. So you could go in and you could record and you could have your album in Chicago 3, 4, 5 days later, which was remarkable. It allowed them to capitalize on a very popular practice at the time, cover records, where if a hot record was out, they could have a copy of it out within 2, 3 weeks of the original coming out. And it gave them a unique advantage. So he was a smart businessman in that sense. And he also was very tough with his contracts. The Delmore brothers, when he brought them in, they were the ones who connected him to all the other talent at WLW. But he convinced them that if they signed for lower and he made them shareholders in the company, it would be in their best interest because then everybody else would sign for lower and the overhead would generally be much lower. The only problem was they were never actually made shareholders. They were just signed to a lower contract. And Alton resented that towards the end. Also, Moo Mullican co-wrote Jambalaya with Hank Williams and tried to get out of his contract so he could collect the royalties for that. But nobody could get him out of the King Records contract, even the manager of the Grand Ole Opry who tried to intervene on his behalf. So when Sid made a deal or he had a contract, he would stick to it. Payola hit in 1959, and he was subpoenaed in September. He admitted it openly. He claimed in a newspaper article that he had quit a couple years earlier voluntarily because he didn't feel like he was getting his records played. There's some evidence that, to the contrary of that, in James Brown's autobiography, he describes handing records to DJs, the DJ opening the sleeve, expecting something to fall out in their hand, and when nothing did, closing it and giving it back to him, and not even refusing to play the record. So, the music industry changed a great deal, but he never was able to find a rock and roll artist that could cross over. Bill Doggett was the closest he came, whose instrumental Honky Tonk was number two when Hound Dog was number one. But he never was able to find an Elvis, let alone a Fats Domino, that could sort of take him into the rock and roll teen craze and sustain the label that way. He also recorded anything that would sell, but he recorded pop, international, he hired Guy Lombardo's arranger. He did a lot of things to try to sell a lot of records in a lot of different ways. He certainly wasn't, he was very ecumenical in his tastes. But it's an interesting example of a record label that was founded by a high school dropout with less than $25,000 that had a lasting impact, I argue, on American music and is often forgotten or underlooked by the general public today. I'm gonna stop there and see if anybody has any questions in particular that I could try to answer. I have records that I could pass out and, oh wait, let me just show a couple quick pictures. This is an advertisement for the Delmore Brothers Hillbilly Boogie. This was in Billboard magazine. it's an interesting example of the Delmore Brothers were one of the best proponents of country boogie music, which is an interesting blend of both country and R&B, and they were on King. It's an example of the kind of mixing that would go on there. Another interesting example of the mixing that would go on there is the Stanley Brothers covered Finger Poppin' Time, which you primarily know as a ballad song. So it's a really interesting mix. There's James Brown, who became the label towards the end. And my last one is a picture of the King Records Studios today. They're still there. They've been used as a warehouse, a distribution facility for a number of companies. But the structure is still there, and there are periodically talks of turning it into a museum or restoring the actual studio space. But no effort has gotten off the ground as of yet. His personality.
And do you know anything about the very first King record where it's supposed to be Earl Travis using the pseudonym Bob McCarthy? Do you know anything about that record that's been found?
Bob McCarthy, they also recorded Grandpa Jones and Earl Travis together under the Shepherd Brothers name. So they were recording under pseudonyms. I think that was cut at the first 43 session in Dayton, and those records I think are really hard to find. I believe so. I came across the same name.
Yes. Do you know if was the Queen label reactivated briefly in the early 60s by King?
I don't know. It's entirely possible, but I doubt it.
Because I've actually seen some labels, and I've seen Brooklyn's King discography just mentioned, maybe about a year, maybe about 4 or 5 releases on the Queen label.
Well, that's interesting. In the King discography.
I think so.
Okay.
Steve. Queen City Records.
Different company.
I don't know whether they own the name on it or something like that.
Well, Cincinnati is known as the Queen City, among other things. Porkopolis.
Records was basically a custom shop.
It's QCA is what they went by, not Queen City Records. That wasn't the real name of the company, but QCA was the name they used on the labels.
Different company.
I know that company well, and I doubt they would have.
The Queen label was folded into King proper in 47, so it was only around for about 3 years.
Actually, I can answer that question. There was Queen City Records and Queen City Album. Yeah. Originally, Queen City Album, i.e. QCA, printed just record jackets. And then Queen City Records was a separate thing. However, when Queen City Album started making records, then Queen City Records changed its name to Bright Records. And it was in Cincinnati into the 90s under that. But my question is, you mentioned that they have plans of turning the King building into a museum. Do they have any plans for excavating a parking lot?
That sounds like a great idea. The last I heard of it, what was in King after Sid Nathan died?
In terms of records, gangsters, etc.
I stopped my, go ahead and fill in the rest of the story.
They dug a giant hole behind the building with all of the metal parts and records.
Oh, wow. They're still there. Yeah. Like the Egyptians. I read interviews that people had done with them. I didn't conduct any myself, but I found other interviews, unpublished and published, with engineers of the time. Hal Neely, Ralph Bass, the interviews that Darren Blaze did some years back. Okay. Okay.
Wow.
That's tremendous. Okay, yeah, that would make the connection. Because Lucky Millinder recorded for King, too. That's great. Eddie, the chief being Sid. Yeah, Sid was the king. Right. Matt.
One more
question from me. Yeah. Yes.
Just wondering, Chubby Checker had this huge hit.
Right.
And done by Hank Ballard.
Right.
King, though Hank Ballard's version was not a big hit.
No.
Label that one, you say, was mainly Jim Brown.
Well.
The publishing must have realized that he would fall off.
Oh, absolutely. That's the publishing company. Well, yeah, exactly. He should have. But Hank Ballard did not. And Hank Ballard came out with Finger Pop in Time shortly after that, which was sort of a second wave. It certainly wasn't as big as The Twist, obviously. I remember reading a story that Hank was supposed to appear on Dick Clark to perform that song, couldn't make it, and then Chubby Checker did, and it took off from there. So if only Hank had made it on Dick Clark instead of Chubby Checker. Inverse of the Snowstorm, exactly.
Okay, well, why don't we go to break just to keep on schedule? Thanks very much to Ben.
We're going to start the next session at 10:15, so there's time to get coffee, but hurry right back. We want to start on time. Thank you.